Tonight on The Readout.
I was reminded of what my opponent said in Paris not too long ago. They asked him to go visit American grave sites. He said no, he wouldn't do it because they were all suckers and losers. Oh. I'm not making that up. Staff was with him, acknowledged it today. Suckers and losers. That man doesn't deserve to have been the commander-in-chief for my son.
President Biden today clearly moved by the malevolence of his opponent, Donald Trump, who used his day off from his criminal trial not to campaign, but rather to meet with a right-wing foreign leader who was once mocked for proposing naming a military base in his country, Fort Trump. Also tonight, Trump whines about not getting unlimited jury strikes, which is not a thing in criminal trials, as he pathetically continues to attack the judge and the prosecutor. Plus, Sergeant Aquilino Gonell, who was brutally beaten by members of Trump's insurrectionist mob on January 6th, joins me as National Guard whistleblowers testify about what really happened on that violent, disgraceful day. But we begin tonight with the remarkable split screen this week from the two major parties' presidential candidates. On Tuesday, while Donald Trump was in a Manhattan courtroom for the second day of his criminal trial, President Biden was in his childhood hometown of Scranton, Pennsylvania, campaigning like a normal candidate, laying out his tax plan that includes ending Trump's tax cut for billionaires and tax relief and economic boosts for regular Americans. During her stay in court, the presumptive Republican nominee spent his time looking agitated and getting admonished by the judge for intimidating a juror. Later in the day, he transitioned to campaigning, visiting a New York City bodega, which, you know, seems totally normal for a campaign, right? Oh, yeah, it was one where years ago an employee killed a man during an altercation. The bodega visit was organized by the New York Young Republicans Club, which you might remember as the group that hosted a gala featuring white nationalists in 2022, and whose leader, Gavin Wax, who was also at the bodega campaign stop, infamously told supporters at an event attended by Trump last December, and I quote, "Once President Trump is back in office, we won't be playing nice anymore. It will be a time for retribution. All those responsible for destroying our once great country will be held to account after baseless years of investigations and government lies and media lies against this man." To which Trump said, "Gavin, that was an excellent speech." Today, we had another remarkable split, a remarkable split screen. President Biden was in Pittsburgh talking about the economy.
Under my predecessor, who's busy right now, Pennsylvania lost 275,000 jobs. I mean, let's look at the facts. On my watch, unemployment hasn't been this low for this long in 50 years.
And where's Trump? Well, he's using his one day off from court this week to have dinner tonight with the right-wing president of Poland, Andrzej Duda. Duda is a semi-autocrat who, much like Trump's favorite European autocrat, Hungary's Viktor Orban, has clamped down on the press and judiciary and feuded with the European Union. He also once proposed naming a Polish military base Fort Trump, prompting much mockery in Poland. But unlike Orban, Duda is a staunch supporter of Ukraine in its war with Russia. Last month, after being hosted by Trump at Mar-a-Lago, Orban crowed about how Trump would end the war in Ukraine by refusing to give them a penny if he's reelected. Donald Trump palling around with European strongmen in what little free time he has these days is a good reminder of what he's done to the Republican Party, making it pro-autocrat and pro-Putin. Even the issue at the heart of what Trump is on trial for now touches on this. I'm sure you remember this.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing.
Well, turns out Russia was listening, because we eventually learned that that was the day that they started hacking the Democratic and the Republican National Committees. And a couple of months later, on October 7th, the Obama administration formally accused Russia of interfering in the 2016 election by hacking into the emails of both the DNC and the RNC. And on that very same day, the Access Hollywood tape at the heart of Trump's hush money case was released, erasing news coverage of the Russian attack, putting Republicans on the spot about how their nominee was a sex pest, rather than how Russia was openly trying to re-elect or trying to elect their pro-Putin, pro-Russia nominee. Because around the same time he was calling on Russia for Hillary Clinton's emails, his campaign was gutting language in the Republican Party platform, calling for the U.S. to provide lethal defensive weapons to the Ukrainian government, which at the time sparked outrage among Republican foreign policy hawks. And the Washington Post reported that as the Obama White House tried to enlist Congress to warn the public about the threat to election systems in the summer of 2016, Republicans resisted, arguing that to warn the public that the election was under attack would further Russia's aim of sapping confidence in the system. Senate Majority Leader at the time, Mitch McConnell, went further, officials said, voicing skepticism that the underlying intelligence truly supported the White House's claims. In fact, additional reporting from the Post found that McConnell made clear to the administration that he would consider any effort by the White House to challenge the Russians publicly an act of partisan politics. McConnell did eventually sign on to a bipartisan letter about election security that literally did not mention the word Russia. But 8 years after conveniently dismissing the threat of Russia to get a pro-corporate tax cut Republican elected to president, who also would deliver Mitch's dream of a right-wing Supreme Court majority, McConnell is back to playing party of Reagan and pushing hard for U.S. aid to Ukraine. Others in the Republican Party, however, now fully enthralled to Trump, are still trying to protect Putin. The Republican chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Mike Turner, said his Republican colleagues are even spreading Russian propaganda on the House floor when discussing the Russia-Ukraine war. While two Republicans, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie of Georgia, are threatening to oust their latest speaker, Mike Johnson, if he poses a bill to provide supplemental aid to Ukraine. Joining me now is Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland, who was a member of the House January 6th Select Committee. Congressman Raskin, it is truly stunning to watch this turnaround in Republicans from being the party of Reagan, who said, you know, who was very much standing up to the USSR, to essentially stumping for Russia on the House floor. How do you read it?
Well, Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, has been recycling direct Russian propaganda. She says that our tax dollars are going to support Ukrainian Nazis. And that is a Putin line, that he's denazifying Ukraine and that it's a Nazi state. Of course, it is a liberal democracy committed to equal rights for everybody and human rights. And it has the only Jewish president in the world outside of Israel. So calling it a Nazi state is such an affront and an insult to the Ukrainian people. And it's just a lie. And yet we're hearing a lot of that coming from various Republican members and different sources, to the point where you're getting now Republican chairmen finally of committees like the Foreign Affairs Committee saying that Russian propaganda has invaded the ranks of the Republican Party.
Let me play there are a lot of them, but this might be one of the most embarrassing and shameful moments in the Trump presidency. Let me play it. This was Trump in Helsinki in July 2018.
All I can do is ask the question. My people came to me, Dan Coats came to me and some others. They said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be. I have great confidence in my intelligence people, but I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today.
And that was on whether or not Russia was interfering in our election. And Congressman Raskin, at the time, that produced gasps, even among Republicans. How did we get to the point where Republicans went from finding that to be an outre and unacceptable comment, even Republicans thinking that, to essentially that being the bottom line? Putin is innocent. Ukraine is guilty. And essentially, effectively, I guess what Mike Johnson's caucus is saying is that the United States must back off and allow Putin to take over Ukraine.
Well, Donald Trump has cemented his alliance with Vladimir Putin and Putin's filthy imperialist invasion of Ukraine, an attack on Ukrainian democracy. It is splitting the Republican Party right now because some of the I don't know what to call them, the more conservative institutionalists who at least maintain some memory of an earlier Republican Party are not willing to throw themselves completely into the Putin, Xi autocrats camp. But of course, then you've got the Matt Gaetz and the Marjorie Taylor Greene and Chip Roy, the hardcore MAGA faction, which will follow Donald Trump in that direction. We'll see this week whether or not the Democrats are going to be able to convince Mike Johnson to hold out and to put Ukraine funding on the floor, because this is the central battlefield between democracy and freedom on one side and tyranny and autocratic corruption on the other. So we just want a clean up or down vote. We know we've got a majority in the House that will support $61 billion for our besieged Ukrainian allies, but it is a desperate situation over there right now. And I don't know whether or not Trump's obsession with Putin is psychological or emotional or economic or financial or political or ideological. It doesn't really make any difference anymore. It's very clear that he stands on the side of Vladimir Putin. And so the struggle between democracy and autocracy is not just between our country and other countries. It is happening within America right now, and it's happening on the floor of the U.S. Congress.
So what do you think is going to happen? I mean, the Senate bill, which I would probably guess a majority of in the House actually support, Mike Johnson, Speaker Johnson, will not put it on the floor. He's now trying to break it up into four like mini bills that are essentially the same as what's in the Senate package, broken up into pieces. The Ukraine piece, a piece for Taiwan, a piece for Israel with included a big piece of humanitarian aid in that one. And then this other bill that he's now proposing that essentially is this, it includes this draconian former HR 2 language, which guts, people's ability to claim asylum. It restarts construction of this border wall. I don't know how you build a wall in the sea, in the Rio Grande River. It rolls back protections for migrant children, requires E-Verify. Is all of this going to pass? Will pieces of it pass? What do you think?
Well, that immigration component is obviously a poison pill and an effort by the ultra-mega right to bring the whole thing crashing down. From the beginning, Donald Trump's made it clear he doesn't want any kind of immigration or border solution. He wants a border crisis. And they know that most of what's in that HR 2 is indigestible to Democrats in the House and the Senate. But really what's going on here is that Vladimir Putin wants to bring the whole package crashing down because he feels like he's got the momentum militarily against Ukraine right now, because the Republicans in Congress have been blockading military aid to our allies there. That is the paramount ethical, moral, and political emergency that we're trying to deal with this week.
The president of Poland, who's on his way out in 2025, the autocratic president, they have a now prime minister that was elected that is a more moderate, sort of normal politician. They're trying to sort of pull back from autocracy. Have you ever heard of a foreign leader meeting not with the current president, but with the former president who's or any political candidate who's not been elected to anything?
Well, nothing is coming to mind right now, but of course, in the encyclopedia of outrages committed by the autocrats and by Donald Trump during this period, that's a relatively slight one, I've got to say. But the main thing here to understand is that the forces of democracy and freedom in the United States and across the world are demanding that we act to help people in Ukraine, because otherwise it's going to be too late. So I hope that Mike Johnson is still moving in the right direction, and the Democrats are hoping that he does the right thing, and it will be a race between his willingness to do the right thing and then the ultra megas trying to overthrow him. But we will try to seek as much stability as possible in the House to make sure the right thing happens.
We are out of time, but very quickly, if he pushes through this Ukraine aid and then they attempt to remove him, will Democrats keep him in power? Will they vote to keep him speaker?
Well, traditionally, we've said that MAGA Republicans have to solve the problems that MAGA Republicans create. But if he does the right thing in getting aid to Ukraine, I think he's going to find a lot of sympathetic Democrats out there.
Congressman Jamie Raskin, always a pleasure. Thank you very much. Up next on the readout, individual ones, crash course in the criminal justice system. No, Donald, you cannot reject every jury you don't like. And yes, the court is moving full steam ahead with opening statements, potentially starting as soon as Monday. The readout continues after this. Much to Donald Trump's dismay, jury selection in his New York hush money election interference trial is moving faster than many expected, with a judge overseeing the trial claiming that at this rate, opening statements could start as soon as Monday. And while Trump once again made this claim,
I know more about courts than any human being on earth. Okay?
Yeah, today he showed his ignorance, at least with the jury selection process, falsely believing he was supposed to be granted unlimited strikes against prospective jurors, which, if true, would theoretically mean he could forever delay the start of a trial by striking every potential juror. What Trump does know more about than any other human being is how to freak out, whine, and rage against the judicial system, the judge, and, of course, the prosecutor, Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg, who he says should be more focused on crime in the city.
It's Alvin Bragg's fault. Alvin Bragg does nothing. He goes after guys like Trump, who did nothing wrong. Violent criminals, murderers, they know there are hundreds of murderers all over the city. They know who they are. They don't pick them up. They go after Trump.
Okay, let's forget for the moment that major crime in New York City has actually gone down this year. The incessant attacks on Bragg from Trump and those on the right have also been a way for them to expand their reach to attack other progressive prosecutors.
He's one of maybe a dozen or more across the country that get elected on an ideological agenda, usually with funding from people like George Soros.
They've weaponized the DA's office there, as they have other Soros-funded DA's offices around the country.
Joining me now is Joyce Vance, former U.S. attorney, professor at the University of Alabama Law School and MSNBC legal analyst, and Rashad Robinson, president of Color of Change, who has backed progressive prosecutors, including Alvin Bragg. Thank you both for being here. I do want to go to you first, Rashad, because the day that Donald Trump's jury selection began in his election interference trial, he floated this memo that named George Soros, they're all Soros-funded prosecutors, and named Color of Change in attacking Alvin Bragg. This has become a thing. Talk a little bit about this trend in attacking people by calling them Soros-funded and also naming Color of Change.
Well, it's no surprise that the rich and powerful, who now sometimes, every once in a while, are held accountable, are going to then go attack the very people who are doing the work to hold them accountable. You know, we have worked for years to make the criminal justice system more fair, to be able to level the field and to be able to bring safety and justice to all people, to all communities. And as part of that effort, we've gone out and we've raised money in that effort to engage in elections. But Joy, I want to demystify what we've used that money for. We've used that money to be able to expand the number of people who vote in these elections. District attorney elections are famously low turnout elections.
Yes.
In fact, we've been in a place where 90% of district attorneys have run unopposed. So we've worked to expand the number of people, particularly at Color of Change, the number of Black people who vote in these elections, making our democracy actually work better for all people. And in that process, we've brought people together around brunches and other events where we've had them contact voters. We've went out and knocked on doors. We've raised money to send mail and to communicate digitally, all in an effort to give people a deep understanding about what's at stake for these offices. In the process, electing district attorneys who will help the little guy, who will stand up for the little guy, who will help to make our systems more fair and to also hold those in power accountable, just like they hold everyone else accountable. And we're not quite there yet. We still have a long way to go. And we also hold the people we put in office accountable. But Donald Trump, just like everything he does, wants to distract us from all of the ways in which he has used the system, used the levers of power, used the levers of government for his own benefit. And so none of us should be distracted. And all of us should be, I think, invested in making sure any and every election has as many people turning out as possible.
Right. I mean, Joyce, this is the thing, is that the, you know, the job of district attorney, the job of attorney general, these are elected offices. And so the justice that's meted out in these communities, to set aside the Donald Trumps who can delay and delay their trials, for ordinary people, it really matters who the DA is, whether or not you're a black or brown person or a person of color or another person of color or a poor person, whether you can get justice. And I just want to list some of the DAs who've been attacked. Kim Fox, she's not seeking a third term. She's been the subject of these kinds of attacks. In San Francisco, Chesa Boudin, who has made crime and homelessness an issue and trying to mitigate, using the criminal justice system to deal with the homelessness problem. You've had in the Tampa Bay Times, you've got this story about DeSantis removed two different state attorneys, Andrew Warren, who refused to prosecute people based on the bans on abortion, and Monique Worrell, essentially, who also was trying to make the criminal justice system more fair to poor people and people of color. I mean, there is a trend, I would say, Joyce. I would include Marilyn Mosby in Maryland, who, you know, people got very angry that she prosecuted police in the Freddie Gray case mm-hmm. and tried to mitigate the sentences of hundreds of people based on improper actions by police. They are attacked based on that. Talk a little bit about this.
Yes, so we hear the explicit appeals to racism and anti-Semitism in these attacks, but there's more to it than just that. As you're pointing out, district attorneys, state and county DAs are elected by the people, and they're responsible to the people when they set their priorities for prosecution. And beyond that, many of these reformer DAs, these and others, represent a shift in criminal justice that says these old policies, these tough on crime policies, have failed again and again. They've led to mass incarceration. They've stripped black communities of an entire generation of young men and young leaders. And they haven't reduced crime. Instead, we have overcrowded prisons. We incarcerate more people than most countries, and we incarcerate them for longer periods of time. So these new prosecutors were elected on smart on crime theories, thinking that we could do more, for instance, with pre-prosecution programs, with community-based programs that were data-based and shown to reduce crime. We see that to some extent in New York City, where crime, as you pointed out, is down. We see that in other communities. But again, the politics of prosecution is interfering with what's best for our communities when someone like Donald Trump appeals to these old, tired sorts of ideas, as opposed to letting prosecutors do the job their communities are electing them to do.
Yeah, amen. And I will note that the one person that has not been attacked by him is Aileen Cannon, who's been very favorable to him. I'm going to give you the last word on this, Rashad, because we've even seen with Alvin Bragg, some of the initiatives he's done are to try to stop using the criminal justice system to deal with mental health, and meaning not disproportionately locking up people who really need mental health concerns. These are the kind of things that make people like Donald Trump despise people like Alvin Bragg, and also, of course, holding people like Donald Trump accountable. I'll give you the last word.
And this is what the people have gone to the polls to ask for, to demand, to vote for. And that has been part of the work. And when donors have given us money to engage in this work, we've actually lifted that up and then also worked to hold those DAs accountable. The attacks from Donald Trump also makes me and my organization unsafe by calling us out on his platform, by using these racist and anti-Semitic tropes that, you know, on one hand, a Jewish donor like George Soros controls everything. And on the other hand, black people are not smart enough to recognize the flaws in the criminal justice system, the deep-seated racism in the justice system, and fight for a better tomorrow. And so all of that is sort of part of why we have to continue to push back, continue to stand up. And if we want district attorneys in office that are going to be fair, that are going to hold the rich and powerful accountable, then we've got to stand with the organizations across our movement doing this work, because Donald Trump would not be attacking us if we were not successful, if we were not making progress, and if we were not doing the absolute important work in this moment of making our justice system more fair for all of us.
Yeah, amen. I worked for a George Soros funded organization, America Coming Together, when I was working on the political side. God bless him. He's doing great work in trying to fund progressive organizations that do the right thing for the people. The attacks on him are pure anti-Semitism, trying to make him sound like some sort of Jewish boogeyman that covers that controls the world. No, he doesn't. He's just got a lot of money, and he, God bless him, tries to do the right thing with his money. God bless that man, and God keep him safe. Joyce Vance, Rashad Robinson, God bless you both, and keep y'all both safe too, because you guys guys are doing the good work as well. Coming up, from one criminal prosecution to another, January 6th is back in the spotlight. What National Guard whistleblowers say Trump could have done to stop the violence. That's next. There was a time not too long ago when all of us understood that what happened on January 6, 2021 was an unacceptable, stunning, and violent assault on our democracy. There was also a time not too long ago when we all witnessed thousands of Trump supporters storm the Capitol, beat police officers, and hunt down politicians. There was also a time not too long ago when we all watched Donald Trump summon that mob and then sit back for 187 minutes and watch them destroy the seat of American democracy as they chanted, "Hang Mike Pence." There was also a time when Trump refused to deploy the National Guard, even though the Guard was ready to go. Today, we heard from National Guard whistleblowers who testified to that point.
We waited for hours, less than 2 miles east of the Capitol building, absolutely frustrating, knowing our Capitol had been breached and not understanding why we had not received the authorization to respond. I cannot tell you the number of times someone has asked me, "Where were you? Where was the National Guard? Or how can you call yourselves Capitol Guardians?" There is no easy response to those questions, and the truth is, we were there, and we were ready. We just weren't authorized to respond, and that is difficult to explain.
3 years later, Donald Trump and MAGA conservatives have gone out of their way to sanitize what happened on that day. From Trump lionizing these violent criminals as hostages, to the RNC calling the assault legitimate political discourse, to the conservatives on the Supreme Court downplaying the violence. Yesterday, the Supreme Court heard an appeal brought by one of the accused violent criminals, Joseph Fisher, who is seeking to dismiss a charge against him of obstructing an official proceeding, which seemed to get a receptive audience from the majority of the conservative justices.
There have been many violent protests that have interfered with proceedings. Has the government applied this provision to other protests in the past?
Would a sit-in that disrupts a trial or access to a federal courthouse qualify? Would a heckler in today's audience qualify?
Let's say that today, while you're arguing or Mr. Green is arguing, five people get up one after the other and they shout either keep the January 6th insurrectionists in jail or free the January 6th patriots. And as a result of this, our police officers have to remove them forcibly from the courtroom.
I just want you to sit for a minute with the fact that one of the justices you just heard, Clarence Thomas, participated in the arguments at all. Given that his wife, Ginny Thomas, attended the January 6th Stop the Steal rally, solicited Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, multiple times to object to the certification, and solicited Republican politicians in swing states to do the same. Husband of insurrectionist, judging insurrection. Good times. What Ginny and the justices seem to forget was the sheer violence of that day, both literal and figurative, a point the Solicitor General pointed out when explaining why this charge was necessary.
We have enforced it in a variety of prosecutions that don't focus on evidence tampering. Now, I can't give you an example of enforcing it in a situation where people have violently stormed a building in order to prevent an official proceeding, a specified one, from occurring with all of the elements like intent to obstruct, knowledge of the proceeding, having the corruptly mens rea, but that's just because I'm not aware of that circumstance ever happening prior to January 6th.
And scene. It might be good for those justices, Trump, and the rest of America to remember what it was like that day. After the break, we'll hear from a former U.S. Capitol Police Sergeant, Aquilino Gonnell, who knows more than most what that January 6th was not a peaceful protest.
There's a continuous shocking attempt to ignore or try to destroy the truth of what truly happened that day and to whitewash the facts into something other than what they all mistakenly reveal, an attack on our democracy by a violent domestic extremists and a stain on our history and our moral standing here, home and abroad.
That was former Capitol Police Sergeant Aquilino Gonell back in 2021, testifying to the January 6th Select Committee about attempts to whitewash what happened on the day he thought he was going to die, attempts that continue to this day at all levels. Sergeant Gonell joins me now. He's the author of American Shield, The Immigrant Sergeant Who Defended Democracy. I want to thank you for all that you did, Sergeant Gonell, on January 6th and for defending our democracy. And I want to just ask you how you feel about the idea that James Fisher, who is the person that is making the argument, for whom the argument is being made in the Supreme Court. Joseph Fisher, who himself was a police officer. He was actually a police officer in Pennsylvania, who went in, yelled charge, ran into the Capitol, wrote it might get violent in a series of texts. He warned his police chief that he might need to post bail. Instead, the chief accompanied federal authorities to arrest him in February 2021. For him to now make the argument that the obstruction charge only refers to shredding paper and not to what he did. How do you feel about that?
Thanks for having your show. And it's very unfortunate that people that swore the same oath as I did on January 6th, they took part in the violence. Instead of removing himself from the violence, he joined them willfully. And it's very disingenuous of him, people like him, to do that, because we are supposed to be held at a higher standard. And he should have known better that we were trying to restore order. He already, probably already seen the violence, where especially on the West Front where I was. So it's total betrayal and also a lack of support for his fellow officers.
And what about Clarence Thomas being able to argue in this case when his wife materially participated in trying to, you know, obstruct the finalization of the election? What about him being a part of those arguments?
My opinion is that he should have probably recused himself, given the fact that how close his wife was to the violence on January 6th. You know, she probably didn't get to go inside because, not because of lack of trying, but because she saw the violence, you know, and it's very unfortunate that instead of holding the law, and holding these people accountable for what they did, they're trying to let these, January 6th insurrectionists, scot-free or easy, with lesser charges instead of putting the full weight of the law. You know, the violence, it was, chaotic. It was gruesome. It was brutal, especially in the West Front, in the tunnel. That's where we made the last stand, especially 30 to 40 officers like myself, Michael Fanon, Hodges. We sustained multiple injuries. We almost died that day. We thought that we were doing the right thing by protecting the elected officials who now has sided with many of the insurrection themselves, as if that day was easy. But on January 6th, they knew who was responsible. And to this day, they only use the police officer as a pawn whenever an immigrant happened to murder somebody. That's the attention that they want to, or the focus as a way to support the police. But where had they been for the past 3 years to talk to Capitol Police officers like a former officer like myself and Harry Dunn? They had not reached out to us to find out what happened, to learn about our experiences. I think if the Supreme Court would like to hear about the violence of January 6th, instead of hearing it from the lawyers of the defendants, they should hear from also from the police officers, and they will have a better perspective on the severity and danger of that day.
I've had the opportunity to ask Harry Dunn and Michael Fanon how they feel when they hear Donald Trump call these people that are locked up, the most violent of the criminals, patriots and mistreated, and to have them sing the national anthem and play that at his rallies. The person who was pleaded guilty to assaulting you, his name is Joshua John Potluck of Smyrna, Tennessee. He was not charged with obstructing an official proceeding, but he was charged with assault, impeding law enforcement, etc. How do you feel about people like him being called wrongly treated patriots and having them be Donald Trump's opening act?
Well, this is something that he's only one out of more than 40 people, close to 70 people that attacked me on that day. This is my 22nd written statement, impact statement in sentencing that I had gone to. It's ongoing. January 6th happened 3 years ago, but for me, it's still ongoing. For those elected officials, it happened for a few hours. And that's a shame that they have sided again with those insurrectionists. Mr. Pollack, I don't know. Today I was in court and, you know, he said he was sorry, but, you know, I don't believe it.
Sergeant Aquilino Gonell, one of the heroes of January 6th. Thank you, sir. Thank you very much for being here. And coming up, the president of Columbia University today facing questions on the school's handling of anti-Semitism some 4 months after a hearing by the same committee led to the resignation of two Ivy League presidents. The Israeli offensive in Gaza continues to roil college campuses nationwide. At the current epicenter is Columbia University, whose president, Dr. Manu Shafiq, faced harsh questioning from a Republican-led House committee over the university's response to anti-Semitism. A focus point was Shafiq's handling of Joseph Massad, a tenured professor at Columbia who published comments in October calling the Hamas attack a stunning victory.
Do you condemn Professor Massad's statement, and has he faced any consequences for it?
Congressman, I do condemn his statement. I am appalled by what he said.
Any consequences?
He has been spoken to.
Spoken to?
And I think you could...
So support of terrorism is acceptable if you're a Columbia professor?
Not at all. And I should say...
He's been spoken to?
I didn't get to... I
have your answer.
No.
let me move on here.
But what's a partisan political witch hunt against academia and free speech without Elise Stefanik? The once normie Republican turned MAGA foot soldier who took a victory lap in January as Harvard University President Claudine Gay announced her resignation after fierce criticism of the university's response to the Hamas attack. Stefanik serves as the fourth in line in the House majority's leadership ranks and is clearly auditioning to be Donald Trump's vice presidential nominee, despite his history of using anti-Semitic tropes.
Has there been disciplinary action taken against students who have chanted from the river to the sea? You see the concern here, though, with the lack of enforcement. You see the concern that speaking to these professors is not enough, and it's sending a message across the university that this is tolerated, these anti-Semitic statements from a position of authority in professors in the classroom is tolerated.
Joining me now is Lex McMenamin, news and politics editor for Teen Vogue. Lex, let's talk about this because it feels like, I mean, there are real incidents. There was a student who was beaten with a stick at Columbia last October, late October after the October 7 attacks. There are real incidents of anti-Semitism, but it kind of feels like what those members of Congress want is to shut down free speech on the other side. Any pro-Palestinian speech must be stopped. People must be fired. How are you reading it?
Right. Well, thank you for having me, Joy. Well, for starters, if you do a brief Google search of the New York Post reporting on that incident regarding the stick beating, as far as I can tell, that person approached someone else. They had an altercation, and then the person got hit on the hand with a stick. So I just want to clarify that it doesn't sound like anyone was jumped with a stick, from what I can tell.
Right.
But that's neither here nor there, because that really wasn't supposed to be the subject of today's hearings whatsoever, right? And so I think something that was very eloquently gotten across by Representatives Omar and Jamal Bowman were critiques of the question of academic freedom, right? So Jamal Bowman read a letter from 600 signed faculty and students speaking on behalf of open free speech on campuses. Representative Omar made a point of asking, firstly, has there even been documentation of anti-Jewish protests on campus? The answer was no. The second question was, have there been any anti-Islamic have there been any Islamophobic protests on campus? The president wasn't given the opportunity to respond to that. Moving on from that, they pointed out that there had been multiple instances of Islamophobic attacks on campuses nationwide, including Columbia's, and there had not yet been any such task force created to address those things. the current anti-Semitism task force that Colombia has in place is ostensibly also supposed to be addressing those critiques of Islamophobia, but there has not been as such a production, let alone a congressional hearing, that would be completely targeting Islamophobic attacks. And if you think about it, what we actually know of quote-unquote hate crimes, alleged hate crimes, or being investigated of hate crimes, have been Islamophobic attacks. In November, three different Palestinian-American students were shot while walking down the street for wearing keffiyehs. This is being investigated as a hate crime in the state of Vermont. One of those college students that was shot, Kenan Abdelhamid, who was a student at Haverford University, wrote an opinion essay, 14 Vogue, lambasting the decision to continue suppressing student voices on campus while also ignoring the active Islamophobia that is going on.
And we just saw USC, the valedictorian, was pulled. She was the valedictorian. She's supposed to speak. She had said pro-Palestinian, I guess, things on her Facebook. And so she's been pulled. They're claiming it was security threats, the reason that this woman cannot speak at her graduation at USC. It feels like that's more the trend, right? The voices of pro-Palestinian students, essentially, and it seems like Congress wants those driven off campus.
Absolutely. And I realized I didn't sort of close the loop here, but what I wanted to say about what Representative Omar was asking is that many of these protests aren't even really directly speaking on the question of Israel and Palestine, or if they are, that's something that's being pulled out of context on the basis of, like, individual people's opinions about that, which obviously we all know that's something that's not going to get resolved tomorrow, right?
Sure.
A lot of these people are talking about just anti-war protests. These are largely anti-war movements, such as Jewish Voice for Peace, which has since October 7th been advocating for a ceasefire. Students for Justice in Palestine has also largely advocated for a ceasefire. And in Colombia, in November, Colombia decided to ban entirely Jewish Voice for Peace and Students for Justice in Palestine from their campus, which is what resulted in the current Colombia apartheid divest coalition we see of over 100 clubs, student clubs on campus, which is who is being penalized now in this process. We've seen really serious protest suppression, not only at Colombia, but I wrote an article earlier this week that was summarizing expulsions, arrests, suspensions, etc., from Vanderbilt to Pomona to Colombia.
Ah, the courage of these institutions as they face a kind of McCarthyism. The courage is just stunning. Lex McMiniman, thank you very much. And that
thank
is
you.
Tonight's readout. Cheers. And by the by, you can follow me on the TikTok at Joy Reid Official and on Instagram at Joy Ann Reid. And please follow our show accounts on Instagram and TikTok at The Readout, so you can always be in the know.